Stores were dark. The two banks were dimly lit. The neon spectacles in the window of the optical shop cast a gimmicky light on the sidewalk. Dacron, Orlan, Lycra Spandex. "I know I forget things," she said, "but I didn't know it was so obvious." "It isn't." "Did you hear Denise?" "When was it? Last week?"
"Denise is smart and tough. No one else notices."
"I dial a number on the phone and forget who I'm calling. I go to the store and forget what to buy. Someone will tell me something. I'll forget it. They'll tell me again. I'll forget it. They'll tell me again, showing a funny-looking smile."
"We all forget," I said.
"I forget names, faces, phone numbers, addresses, appointments, instructions, directions."
"It's something that's just been happening, more or less, to everyone."
"I forget that Steffi doesn't like to be called Stephanie. Sometimes I call her Denise. I forget where I've parked the car, and then for a long, long moment I forget what the car looks like."
"Forgetfulness has gotten into the air and water. It's entered the food chain."
"Maybe it's the gum I chew. Is that too far-fetched?"
"Maybe it's something else."
"What do you mean?"
"You're taking something besides chewing gum."
"Where did you get that idea?"
"I got it second-hand from Steffi."
"Who did Steffi get it from?"
"Denise."
She paused, conceding the possibility that if Denise is the source of a rumor or theory, it could very well be true.
"What does Denise say I'm taking?"
"I wanted to ask you before I asked her."
"To the best of my knowledge, Jack, I'm not taking anything that could account for my memory lapses. On the other hand, I'm not old, I haven't suffered an injury to the head, and there's nothing in my family background except tipped uteruses."
"You're saying maybe Denise is right?"
"We can't rule it out."
"You're saying maybe you're taking something that has the side effect of impairing memory?"
"Either I'm taking something and I don't remember, or I'm not taking something and I don't remember. My life is either or. Either I chew regular gum or I chew sugarless gum. Either I chew gum or I smoke. Either I smoke or I gain weight. Either I gain weight or I run up the stadium steps."
"Sounds like a boring life."
"I hope it lasts forever," she said.
Soon the streets were covered with leaves. Leaves came tumbling and scraping down the pitched roofs. There were periods in every day when a stiff wind blew, bearing the trees further, and retired men appeared in the backyards, on the small lawns out front, carrying rakes with curved teeth. Black bags were arrayed at the curbstone in lopsided rows. A series of frightened children appeared at our door for their Halloween treats. Chapter 12. I went to German lessons twice a week, in the late afternoon, darkness crowding in earlier with each succeeding visit. It was Howard Dunlop's working rule that we sit facing each other during the full length of the lesson. He wanted me to study his tongue positions as he demonstrated the pronunciation of consonants, diphthongs, long and short vowels. He, in turn, would look closely into my mouth as I attempted to reproduce the unhappy sounds. His was a mild and quiet face, an oval surface with no hint of distinctiveness, until he started his vocal routines. Then the warping began. It was an eerie thing to see, shamefully fascinating, as a seizure might be if witnessed in a controlled environment. He tucked his head into his trunk, narrowed his eyes, made grimacing, humanoid faces. When it was time for me to repeat the noises, I did likewise, if only to please the teacher, twisting my mouth, shutting my eyes completely, conscious of an over-articulation so tortured
It must have sounded like a sudden bending of the natural law, a stone or tree struggling to speak. When I opened my eyes, he was only inches from my mouth, leaning in to peer. I used to wonder what he saw in there. There were strained silences before and after each lesson. I tried to make small talk, get him to discuss his years as a chiropractor, his life before German. He would look off into the middle distance, not angry or bored or evasive, just detached, free of the connectedness of events, it seemed. When he did speak, about the other boarders or the landlord, there was something querulous in his voice, a drawn-out note of complaint. It was important for him to believe that he'd spent his life among people who kept missing the point. "How many students do you have?"
"For German?"
"Yes."
"You're the only one I have for German. I used to have others. German has fallen off. These things go in cycles like everything else."
"What else do you teach?"
"Greek, Latin, ocean sailing."
"People come here to learn ocean sailing?"
"Not so much anymore."
"It's amazing how many people teach these days," I said.
"There is a teacher for every person. Everyone I know is either a teacher or a student."
"What do you think it means?"
He looked off toward a closet door.
"Do you teach anything else?" I said.
"Meteorology."
"Meteorology? How did that come about?"
"My mother's death had a terrible impact on me. I collapsed totally, lost my faith in God. I was inconsolable, withdrew completely into myself. Then, one day, by chance, I saw a weather report on TV. A dynamic young man with a glowing pointer stood before a multicolored satellite photo, predicting the weather for the next 5 days. I sat there, mesmerized by his self-assurance and skill. It was as though a message was being transmitted from the weather satellite through that young man and then to me in my canvas chair. I turned to meteorology for comfort. I read weather maps, collected books on weather, attended launchings of weather balloons. I realized weather was something I'd been looking for all my life. It brought me a sense of peace and security I'd never experienced. Dew, frost and fog, snow flurries, the jet stream. I believe there is a grandeur in the jet stream. I began to come out of my shell, talk to people in the street. "Nice day. Looks like rain. Hot enough for you?" Everyone notices the weather. First thing on rising, you go to the window, look at the weather. You do it, I do it. I made a list of goals I hoped to achieve in meteorology. I took a correspondence course, got a degree to teach the subject in buildings with a legal occupancy of less than 100. I've taught meteorology in church basements, in trailer parks, in people's dens and living rooms. They came to hear me in Miller's Creek, Lumberville, Watertown. Factory workers, housewives, merchants, members of the police and the fire. I saw something in their eyes. A hunger. A compelling need. There were little holes in the cuffs of his thermal undershirt. We were standing in the middle of the room. I waited for him to go on. It was the time of year, the time of day, for a small, insistent sadness to pass into the texture of things. Dusk, silence, iron chill. Something lonely in the bone. When I got home, Bob Pardee was in the kitchen practicing his golf swing. Bob is Denise's father. He said he was driving through town on his way to Glassboro to make a presentation, and thought he'd take us all to dinner. He swung his locked hands in slow motion over his left shoulder, following through smoothly. Denise eyed him from a stool by the window. He wore a half-shaggy cardigan with sleeves that draped over the cuffs.
"What kind of presentation?" she said.
"Oh, you know, charts, arrows, slap some colors on a wall. It's a basic outreach tool, sweetheart."
"Did you change jobs again?"
"I'm raising funds. Busy as hell, too, better believe."
"What kind of funds?"
"Just whatever's out there, you know. People want to give me food stamps, etchings. Hey, great, I don't mind."
He was bent over a putt. Babette leaned on the refrigerator door with her arms folded, watching him. Upstairs, a British voice said, "There are forms of vertigo that do not include spinning."
"Funds for what?" Denise said.
"There's a little thing you might have had occasion to hear of called the Nuclear Accident Readiness Foundation. Basically a legal defense fund for the industry. Just in case kind of thing."
"Just in case what?"
"Just in case I faint from hunger. Let's sneak up on some ribs, why don't we? You got your leg men, you got your breast men. Babette, what do you say? I'm about semi-prepared to slaughter my own animal."
"How many jobs is this, anyway?"
"Don't pester me, Denise."
"Never mind, I don't care. Do what you want."
Bob took the three older kids to the wagon wheel. I drove Babette to the River Edge house, where she would read to Mr. Treadwell, the blind old man who lived there with his sister. Wilder sat between us, playing with the supermarket tabloids that Treadwell favored as reading matter. As a volunteer reader to the blind, Babette had some reservations about the old gent's appetite for the unspeakable and seamy, believing that the handicapped were morally bound to higher types of entertainment. If we couldn't look to them for victories of the human spirit, who could we look to? They had an example to set, just as she did as a reader and morale booster. But she was professional in her duty, reading to him with high earnestness, as to a child, about dead men who leave messages on answering machines. Wilder and I waited in the car. The plan was that after the reading, the three of us would meet the wagon wheel group at the Dinky Donut, where they would have dessert and we would have dinner. I'd brought along a copy of Mein Kampf for that segment of the evening. The Treadwell house was an old frame structure with rotting trellises along the porch. Less than 5 minutes after she'd entered, Babette came out, walked uncertainly to the far end of the porch, and peered across the dim yard. Then she walked slowly toward the car.
"Door was open. I went in. Nobody. I looked around. Nothing. Nobody. I went upstairs. No sign of life. There doesn't seem to be anything missing."
"What do you know about his sister?"
"She's older than he is, and probably in worse shape if you disregard the fact that he's blind and she isn't."
The two nearest houses were dark, both up for sale, and no one at four other houses in the area knew anything about the Treadwells' movements over the past few days. We drove to the state trooper barracks and talked to a female clerk who sat behind a computer console. She told us there was a disappearance every 11 seconds, and taped everything we said. At the Dinky Donut, outside town, Bob Pardee sat quietly as the family ate and talked. The soft, pink golfer's face had begun to droop from his skull. His flesh seemed generally to sag, giving him the hangdog look of someone under strict orders to lose weight. His hair was expensively cut and layered, a certain amount of color combed in, a certain amount of technology brought to bear. But it seemed to need a more dynamic head.
I realized Babette was looking at him carefully, trying to grasp the meaning of the 4 careening years they'd spent as man and wife. The panoramic carnage. He drank, gambled, drove his car down embankments, got fired, quit, retired, traveled in disguise to Coal Town, where he paid a woman to speak Swedish to him as they screwed. It was the Swedish that enraged Babette. Either that or his need to confess it. And she hit out at him. Hit out with the backs of her hands, with her elbows and wrists. Old loves, old fears. Now she watched him with a tender sympathy, a reflectiveness that seemed deep and fond and generous enough to contain all the magical counterspells to his current run of woe. Although I knew, of course, as I went back to my book, that it was only a passing affection, one of those kindnesses no one understands. By noon the next day they were dragging the river. Chapter 13. The students tend to stick close to campus. There is nothing for them to do in Blacksmith proper, no natural haunt or attraction. They have their own food, movies, music, theater, sports, conversation, and sex. This is a town of dry cleaning shops and opticians. Photos of looming Victorian homes decorate the windows of real estate firms. These pictures have not changed in years. The homes are sold, or gone, or stand in other towns in other states. This is a town of tag sales and yard sales, the failed possessions arrayed in driveways and tended by kids. Babette called me at my office in Centenary Hall. She said Heinrich had been down at the river, wearing his camouflage cap and carrying an instamatic, to watch them drag for the bodies. And while he was there, word came that the Treadwells had been found alive but shaken in an abandoned cookie shack at the Mid-Village Mall, a vast shopping center out on the interstate. Apparently, they'd been wandering through the mall for 2 days, lost, confused, and frightened, before taking refuge in the littered kiosk. They spent 2 more days in the kiosk, the weak and faltering sister venturing out to scavenge food scraps from the cartoon character disposal baskets with swinging doors. It was sheer luck that their stay at the mall coincided with a spell of mild weather. No one knew at this point why they didn't ask for help. It was probably just the vastness and strangeness of the place, and their own advanced age that made them feel helpless and adrift in a landscape of remote and menacing figures. The Treadwells didn't get out much. In fact, no one yet knew how they'd managed to get to the mall. Possibly their grand-niece had dropped them off in her car and then forgotten to pick them up. The grand-niece could not be reached, Babette said, for comment. The day before the happy discovery, the police had called in a psychic to help them determine the Treadwells' whereabouts and fate. It was all over the local paper. The psychic was a woman who lived in a mobile home in a wooded area outside town. She wished to be known only as Adele T. According to the paper, she and the police chief, Hollis Wright, sat in the mobile home while she looked at photos of the Treadwells and smelled articles from their wardrobe. Then she asked the chief to leave her alone for an hour. She did exercises, ate some rice and dal, proceeded to trance in. During this altered state, the report went on, she attempted to put a data trace on whatever distant physical systems she wished to locate, in this case Old Man Treadwell and his sister. When Chief Wright re-entered the trailer, Adele T. told him to forget the river and to concentrate on dry land with a moonscape look about it, within a 15-mile radius of the Treadwell home. The police went at once to a gypsum processing operation 10 miles downriver, where they found an airline bag that contained a handgun and 2 kilos of uncut heroin. The police had consulted Adele T. on a number of occasions, and she had led them to 2 bludgeoned bodies, a Syrian in a refrigerator, and a cache of marked bills totaling $600,000, although in each instance, the report concluded, the police had been looking for something else. The American mystery deepens. Chapter 14. We crowded before the window in Steffi's small room, watching the spectacular sunset. Only Heinrich stayed away, either because he distrusted wholesome communal pleasures, or because he believed there was something ominous in the modern sunset. Later, I sat up in bed in my bathrobe studying German. I muttered words to myself, and wondered whether I'd be able to restrict my German speaking at the spring conference to brief opening remarks, or whether the other participants would expect the language to be used throughout, in lectures, at meals, in small talk, as a mark of our seriousness, our uniqueness in world scholarship. The TV said, and other trends that could dramatically impact your portfolio. Denise came in and sprawled across the foot of the bed, her head resting on her folded arms, facing away from me. How many codes, countercodes, social histories were contained in this simple posture? A full minute passed. "What are we going to do about Baba?" she said. "What do you mean?" "She can't remember anything." "Did she ask you whether she's taking medication?" "No." "No, she's not, or no, she didn't ask?" "She didn't ask." "She was supposed to," I said. "Well, she didn't." "How do you know she's taking something?" "I saw the bottle buried in the trash under the kitchen sink. A prescription bottle. It had her name and the name of the medication." "What is the name of the medication?" "Dilar. 1 every 3 days. Which sounds like it's dangerous or habit-forming or whatever." "What dose does your drug reference say about Dilar?" "It's not in there. I spent hours. There are 4 indexes. It must be recently marketed. Do you want me to double-check the book?" "I already looked. I looked!" "We could always call her doctor. But I don't want to make too much of this. Everybody takes some kind of medication. Everybody forgets things occasionally." "Not like my mother. I forget things all the time." "What do you take?" "Blood pressure pills, stress pills, allergy pills, eye drops, aspirin. Run-of-the-mill." "I looked in the medicine chest in your bathroom." "No Dilar?" "I thought there might be a new bottle." "The doctor prescribed 30 pills. That was it. Run-of-the-mill. Everybody takes something." "I still want to know," she said. All this time she'd been turned away from me. There were plot potentials in this situation, chances for people to make devious maneuvers, secret plans. But now she shifted position, used an elbow to prop her upper body, and watched me speculatively from the foot of the bed. "Can I ask you something?" "Sure," I said. "You won't get mad?" "You know what's in my medicine chest. What secrets are left?" "Why did you name Heinrich Heinrich?" "Fair question." "You don't have to answer." "Good question. No reason why you shouldn't ask." "So, why did you?" "I thought it was a forceful name, a strong name. It has a kind of authority." "Is he named after anyone?" "No. He was born shortly after I started the department, and I guess I wanted to acknowledge my good fortune. I wanted to do something German. I felt a gesture was called for.
Heinrich Gerhard Gladney?
I thought it had an authority that might cling to him. I thought it was forceful and impressive, and I still do. I wanted to shield him, make him unafraid. People were naming their children Kim, Kelly, and Tracy. There was a long silence. She kept watching me. Her features, crowded somewhat in the center of her face, gave to her moments of concentration a puggish and half-belligerent look. "Do you think I miscalculated?"
"It's not for me to say."
"There's something about German names, the German language, German things. I don't know what it is exactly. It's just there. In the middle of it all is Hitler, of course.
He was on again last night."
"He's always on. We couldn't have television without him."
"They lost the war," she said. "How great could they be?"
"A valid point. But it's not a question of greatness. It's not a question of good and evil. I don't know what it is. Look at it this way. Some people always wear a favorite color. Some people carry a gun. Some people put on a uniform and feel bigger, stronger, safer. It's in this area that my obsessions dwell." Steffi came in wearing Denise's green visor. I didn't know what this meant. She climbed up on the bed, and all three of us went through my German-English dictionary, looking for words that sound about the same in both languages, like orgy and shoe. Heinrich came running down the hall, burst into the room.
"Come on, hurry up, plane crash footage!"
Then he was out the door. The girls were off the bed, all three of them running along the hall to the TV set. I sat in bed a little stunned. The swiftness and noise of their leaving had put the room in a state of molecular agitation. In the debris of invisible matter, the question seemed to be, "What is happening here?" By the time I got to the room at the end of the hall, there was only a puff of black smoke at the edge of the screen. But the crash was shown two more times, once in stop-action replay, as an analyst attempted to explain the reason for the plunge. A jet trainer in an air show in New Zealand. We had two closet doors that opened by themselves. That night, a Friday, we gathered in front of the set, as was the custom and the rule, with takeout Chinese. There were floods, earthquakes, mudslides, erupting volcanoes. We'd never before been so attentive to our duty, our Friday assembly. Heinrich was not sullen. I was not bored. Steffi, brought close to tears by a sitcom husband arguing with his wife, appeared totally absorbed in these documentary clips of calamity and death. Babette tried to switch to a comedy series about a group of racially mixed kids who build their own communications satellite. She was startled by the force of our objection. We were otherwise silent, watching houses slide into the ocean, whole villages crackle and ignite in a mass of advancing lava. Every disaster made us wish for more, for something bigger, grander, more sweeping. I walked into my office on Monday to find Murray sitting in the chair adjacent to the desk, like someone waiting for a nurse to arrive with a blood pressure gauge. He'd been having trouble, he said, establishing an Elvis Presley power base in the Department of American Environments. The chairman, Alphonse Stompanato, seemed to feel that one of the other instructors, a 300-pound former rock and roll bodyguard named Dimitrios Kotsakis, had established prior right by having flown to Memphis when the king died. interviewed members of the king's entourage and family. Ben interviewed himself on local television as an interpreter of the phenomenon. A more than middling coup, Murray conceded. I suggested that I might drop by his next lecture, informally, unannounced, simply to lend a note of consequence to the proceedings, to give him the benefit of whatever influence and prestige might reside in my office, my subject, my physical person. He nodded slowly, fingering the ends of his beard. Later at lunch I spotted only one empty chair at a table occupied by the New York émigrés. Alphonse sat at the head of the table, a commanding presence even in a campus lunchroom. He was large, sardonic, dark-staring, with scarred brows and a furious beard fringed in gray. It was the very beard I would have grown in 1969 if Janet Savory, my second wife, Heinrich's mother, hadn't argued against it. "Let them see that bland expanse," she said, in her tiny, dry voice. "It is more effective than you think." Alphonse invested everything he did with a sense of all-consuming purpose. He knew four languages, had a photographic memory, did complex mathematics in his head. He'd once told me that the art of getting ahead in New York was based on learning how to express dissatisfaction in an interesting way. The air was full of rage and complaint. People had no tolerance for your particular hardship unless you knew how to entertain them with it. Alphonse himself was occasionally entertaining in a pulverizing way. He had a manner that enabled him to absorb and destroy all opinions in conflict with his. When he talked about popular culture, he exercised the closed logic of a religious zealot, one who kills for his beliefs. His breathing grew heavy, arrhythmic. His brows seemed to lock. The other émigrés appeared to find his challenges and taunts a proper context for their endeavor. They used his office to pitch pennies to the wall. I said to him, "Why is it, Alphonse, that decent, well-meaning, and responsible people find themselves intrigued by catastrophe when they see it on television?" I told him about the recent evening of lava, mud, and raging water that the children and I had found so entertaining. "We wanted more. More." "It's natural. It's normal," he said with a reassuring nod. "It happens to everybody."
"Why?"
"Because we're suffering from brain fade. We need an occasional catastrophe to break up the incessant bombardment of information."
"It's obvious," Lasher said, a slight man with a taut face and slicked-back hair.
"The flow is constant," Alphonse said. "Words, pictures, numbers, facts, graphics, statistics, specks, waves, particles, motes. Only a catastrophe gets our attention. We want them. We need them. We depend on them. As long as they happen somewhere else. This is where California comes in. Mudslides, brush fires, coastal erosion, earthquakes, mass killings, etc. We can relax and enjoy these disasters because in our hearts we feel that California deserves whatever it gets. Californians invented the concept of lifestyle. This alone warrants their doom."
Kotsakis crushed a can of Diet Pepsi and threw it at a garbage pail.
"Japan is pretty good for disaster footage," Alphonse said. "India remains largely untapped. They have tremendous potential with their famines, monsoons, religious strife, train wrecks, boat sinkings, etc. But their disasters tend to go unrecorded. Three lines in the newspaper. No film footage, no satellite hookup. This is why California is so important. We not only enjoy seeing them punished for their relaxed lifestyle and progressive social ideas, but we know we're not missing anything. The cameras are right there. They're standing by. Nothing terrible escapes their scrutiny."
You're saying it's more or less universal to be fascinated by TV disasters.
For most people, there are only two places in the world, where they live and their TV set. If a thing happens on television, we have every right to find it fascinating, whatever it is.
I don't know whether to feel good or bad about learning that my experience is widely shared.
Feel bad, he said.
It's obvious, Lasher said, we all feel bad, but we can enjoy it on that level.
Murray said, this is what comes from the wrong kind of attentiveness. People get brain fade. This is because they've forgotten how to listen and look as children. They've forgotten how to collect data. In the psychic sense, a forest fire on TV is on a lower plane than a 10-second spot for automatic dishwasher all. The commercial has deeper waves, deeper emanations. But we have reversed the relative significance of these things. This is why people's eyes, ears, brains, and nervous systems have grown weary. It's a simple case of misuse.
Grappa casually tossed half a buttered roll at Lasher, hitting him on the shoulder. Grappa was pale and baby fattish, and the tossed roll was an attempt to get Lasher's attention.
Grappa said to him, did you ever brush your teeth with your finger?
I brushed my teeth with my finger the first time I stayed overnight at my wife's parents' house, before we were married, when her parents spent a weekend at Asbury Park. They were an Ipana family.
Forgetting my toothbrush is a fetish with me, Kotsakis said. I brushed my teeth with my finger at Woodstock, Altamont, Monterey, about a dozen other seminal events.
Grappa looked at Murray.
I brushed my teeth with my finger after the Ali Foreman fight in Zaire, Murray said. That's the southernmost point I've ever brushed my teeth with my finger at.
Lasher looked at Grappa.
Did you ever crap in a toilet bowl that had no seat?
Grappa's response was semi-lyrical. A great and funky men's room in an old Saucony mobile station on the Boston Post Road the first time my father took the car outside the city. The station with the flying red horse. You want the car? I can give you car details down to the last little option.
These are the things they don't teach, Lasher said. Bowls with no seats, pissing in sinks. The culture of public toilets. All those great diners, movie houses, gas stations. The whole ethos of the road. I've pissed in sinks all through the American West. I've slipped across the border to piss in sinks in Manitoba and Alberta. This is what it's all about. The great western skies. The best western motels. The diners and drive-ins. The poetry of the road, the plains, the desert. The filthy, stinking toilets. I pissed in a sink in Utah when it was 22 below. That's the coldest I've ever pissed in a sink in.
Alphonse Stompanato looked hard at Lasher.
Where were you when James Dean died? He said in a threatening voice.
In my wife's parents' house before we were married, listening to make-believe ballroom on the old Emerson table model. The Motorola with the glowing dial was already a thing of the past.
"You've spent a lot of time in your wife's parents' house, it seems, screwing," Alphonse said.
"We were kids. It was too early in the cultural matrix for actual screwing."
"What were you doing?"
"She's my wife, Alphonse. You want me to tell a crowded table?"
"James Dean is dead, and you're groping some 12-year-old."
Alphonse glared at Dimitrios Katsakis.
"Where were you when James Dean died?"
"In the back of my uncle's restaurant in Astoria, Queens, vacuuming with the Hoover."
Alphonse looked at Grappa.
"Where the hell were you?" he said,
as if the thought had just occurred to him that the actor's death was not complete without some record of Grappa's whereabouts.
"I know exactly where I was, Alphonse. Let me think a minute." "Where were you, you son of a bitch?"
"I always know these things down to the smallest detail. But I was a dreamy adolescent. I have these gaps in my life."
You were busy jerking off. Is that what you mean?
Ask me Joan Crawford.
September 30, 1955. James Dean dies. Where is Nicholas Grappa, and what is he doing?
Ask me Gable.
Ask me Monroe.
The silver Porsche approaches an intersection going like a streak. No time to brake for the Ford sedan. Glass shatters, metal screams. Jimmy Dean sits in the driver's seat with a broken neck, multiple fractures and lacerations. It is 5:45 in the afternoon Pacific Coast time. Where is Nicholas Grappa, the jerk-off king of the Bronx?
Ask me Jeff Chandler.
You're a middle-aged man, Nicky, who traffics in his own childhood. You have an obligation to produce.
Ask me John Garfield. Ask me Monty Clift.
Kotsakis was a monolith of thick and wadded flesh. He'd been Little Richard's personal bodyguard, and had led security details at rock concerts before joining the faculty here.
Elliot Lasher threw a chunk of raw carrot at him, then asked,
"Did you ever have a woman peel flaking skin from your back after a few days at the beach?"
"Cocoa Beach, Florida," Kotsakis said. "It was very tremendous. The second or third greatest experience of my life."
"Was she naked?" Lasher said.
"To the waist," Kotsakis said.
"From which direction?" Lasher said.
I watched Grappa throw a cracker at Murray. He skimmed it backhand like a frisbee.
Chapter 15. I put on my dark glasses, composed my face, and walked into the room. There were 25 or 30 young men and women, many in fall colors, seated in armchairs and sofas and on the beige broadloom. Murray walked among them, speaking, his right hand trembling in a stylized way. When he saw me, he smiled sheepishly. I stood against the wall, attempting to loom, my arms folded under the black gown. Murray was in the midst of a thoughtful monologue.
Did his mother know that Elvis would die young? She talked about assassins. She talked about the life of a star of this type and magnitude. Isn't the life structured to cut you down early? This is the point, isn't it? There are rules, guidelines. If you don't have the grace and wit to die early, you are forced to vanish, to hide as if in shame and apology. She worried about his sleepwalking. She thought he might go out a window. I have a feeling about mothers. Mothers really do know. The folklore is correct.
Hitler adored his mother, I said.
A surge of attention, unspoken, identifiable only in a certain convergence of stillness, an inward tensing. Murray kept moving, of course, but a bit more deliberately, picking his way between the chairs, the people seated on the floor. I stood against the wall, arms folded.
"Elvis and Gladys liked to nuzzle and pet," he said. "They slept in the same bed until he began to approach physical maturity. They talked baby talk to each other all the time."
"Hitler was a lazy kid. His report card was full of unsatisfactories. But Clara loved him, spoiled him, gave him the attention his father failed to give him. She was a quiet woman, modest and religious, and a good cook and housekeeper."
"Gladys walked Elvis to school and back every day. She defended him in little street rumbles, lashed out at any kid who tried to bully him."
"Hitler fantasized. He took piano lessons, made sketches of museums and villas. He sat around the house a lot. Clara tolerated this. He was the first of her children to survive infancy. Three others had died."
"Elvis confided in Gladys. He brought his girlfriends around to meet her."
"Hitler wrote a poem to his mother. His mother and his niece were the women with the greatest hold on his mind."
"When Elvis went into the army, Gladys became ill and depressed. She sensed something, maybe as much about herself as about him. Her psychic apparatus was flashing all the wrong signals, foreboding and gloom. There's not much doubt that Hitler was what we call a mama's boy.
A note-taking young man murmured absently, "Mutterzonken." I regarded him warily. Then, on an impulse, I abandoned my stance at the wall and began to pace the room like Murray, occasionally pausing to gesture, to listen, to gaze out a window or up at the ceiling.
Elvis could hardly bear to let Gladys out of his sight when her condition grew worse. He kept a vigil at the hospital. When his mother became severely ill, Hitler put a bed in the kitchen to be closer to her. He cooked and cleaned. Elvis fell apart with grief when Gladys died. He fondled and petted her in the casket. He talked baby talk to her until she was in the ground. Clara's funeral cost 370 kronen. Hitler wept at the grave and fell into a period of depression and self-pity. He felt an intense loneliness. He'd lost not only his beloved mother, but also his sense of home and hearth.
It seems fairly certain that Gladys's death caused a fundamental shift at the center of the king's worldview. She'd been his anchor, his sense of security. He began to withdraw from the real world to enter the state of his own dying. For the rest of his life, Hitler could not bear to be anywhere near Christmas decorations, because his mother had died near a Christmas tree. Elvis made death threats, received death threats. He took mortuary tours and became interested in UFOs. He began to study the Bardo Todol, commonly known as the Tibetan Book of the Dead. This is a guide to dying and being reborn. Years later, in the grip of self-myth and deep remoteness, Hitler kept a portrait of his mother in his Spartan quarters at Obersalzburg. He began to hear a buzzing in his left ear. Murray and I passed each other near the center of the room, almost colliding. Alphonse Stampinato entered, followed by several students, drawn perhaps by some magnetic wave of excitation, some frenzy in the air. He settled his surly bulk in a chair as Murray and I circled each other and headed off in opposite directions, avoiding an exchange of looks. Elvis fulfilled the terms of the contract. Excess, deterioration, self-destructiveness, grotesque behavior, a physical bloating and a series of insults to the brain, self-delivered. His place in legend is secure. He bought off the skeptics by dying early, horribly, unnecessarily. No one could deny him now. His mother probably saw it all as on a 19-inch screen years before her own death. Murray, happily deferring to me, went to a corner of the room and sat on the floor, leaving me to pace and gesture alone, secure in my professional aura of power, madness, and death. Hitler called himself the lonely wanderer out of nothingness. He sucked on lozenges, spoke to people in endless monologues, free associating, as if the language came from some vastness beyond the world, and he was simply the medium of revelation. It's interesting to wonder if he looked back from the Führer bunker, beneath the burning city, to the early days of his power. Did he think of the small groups of tourists who visited the little settlement where his mother was born, and where he'd spent summers with his cousins, riding in ox carts and making kites? They came to honor the site, Clara's birthplace. They entered the farmhouse, poked around tentatively. Adolescent boys climbed on the roof. In time, the numbers began to increase. They took pictures, slipped small items into their pockets. Then crowds came, mobs of people overrunning the courtyard and singing patriotic songs, painting swastikas on the walls, on the flanks of farm animals. Crowds came to his mountain villa, so many people he had to stay indoors. They picked up pebbles where he'd walked, and took them home as souvenirs.
Crowds came to hear him speak, crowds erotically charged, the masses he once called his only bride.
He closed his eyes, clenched his fists as he spoke, twisted his sweat-drenched body, remade his voice as a thrilling weapon. Sex murders, someone called these speeches. Crowds came to be hypnotized by the voice, the party anthems, the torchlight parades. I stared at the carpet and counted silently to 7. But wait. How familiar this all seems. How close to ordinary. Crowds come, get worked up, touch and press, people eager to be transported. Isn't this ordinary? We know all this. There must have been something different about those crowds. What was it? Let me whisper the terrible word from the old English, from the old German, from the old Norse. Death. Many of those crowds were assembled in the name of death. They were there to attend tributes to the dead. Processions, songs, speeches, dialogues with the dead, recitations of the names of the dead. They were there to see pyres and flaming wheels, thousands of flags dipped in salute, thousands of uniformed mourners. There were ranks and squadrons, elaborate backdrops, blood banners and black dress uniforms. Crowds came to form a shield against their own dying. To become a crowd is to keep out death. To break off from the crowd is to risk death as an individual, to face dying alone. Crowds came for this reason above all others. They were there to be a crowd. Murray sat across the room. His eyes showed a deep gratitude. I had been generous with the power and madness at my disposal, allowing my subject to be associated with an infinitely lesser figure, a fellow who sat in lazy boy chairs and shut out TVs. It was not a small matter. We all had an aura to maintain, and in sharing mine with a friend, I was risking the very things that made me untouchable. People gathered round, students and staff, and in the mild din of half-heard remarks and orbiting voices, I realized we were now a crowd. Not that I needed a crowd around me now, least of all now. Death was strictly a professional matter here. I was comfortable with it. I was on top of it. Murray made his way to my side and escorted me from the room, parting the crowd with his fluttering hand. Chapter 16. This was the day Wilder started crying at 2 in the afternoon. At 6 he was still crying, sitting on the kitchen floor and looking through the oven window. And we ate dinner quickly, moving around him or stepping over him to reach the stove and refrigerator. Babette watched him as she ate. She had a class to teach in sitting, standing, and walking. It would start in an hour and a half. She looked at me in a drained and supplicating way. She'd spoken soothingly to him, hefted and caressed him, checked his teeth, given him a bath, examined him, tickled him, fed him, tried to get him to crawl into his vinyl play tunnel. Her old people would be waiting in the church basement. It was rhythmic crying, a measured statement of short, urgent pulses. At times it seemed he would break off into a whimper, an animal complaint, irregular and exhausted. But the rhythm held, the heightened beat, the washed pink sorrow in his face. "We'll take him to the doctor," I said. "Then I'll drop you at the church." "Would the doctor see a crying child? Besides, his doctor doesn't have hours now."
"What about your doctor?"
"I think he does. But a crying child, Jack?
What can I say to the man? My child is crying? Is there a condition more basic? There had been no sense of crisis until now, just exasperation and despair. But once we decided to visit the doctor, we began to hurry, to fret. We looked for Wilder's jacket and shoes, tried to remember what he'd eaten in the last 24 hours, anticipated questions the doctor would ask, and rehearsed our answers carefully. It seemed vital to agree on the answers, even if we weren't sure they were correct. Doctors lose interest in people who contradict each other. This fear has long informed my relationship with doctors, that they would lose interest in me, instruct their receptionists to call other names before mine, take my dying for granted.
I waited in the car while Babette and Wilder went into the medical building at the end of Elm. Doctors' offices depress me even more than hospitals do, because of their air of negative expectancy, and because of the occasional patient who leaves with good news, shaking the doctor's antiseptic hand and laughing loudly, laughing at everything the doctor says, booming with laughter, with crude power, making a point of ignoring the other patients as he walks past the waiting room still laughing provocatively. He is already clear of them, no longer associated with their weekly gloom, their anxious inferior dying. I would rather visit an emergency ward, some urban well of trembling, where people come in gut-shot, slashed, sleepy-eyed with opium compounds, broken needles in their arms. These things have nothing to do with my own eventual death, nonviolent, small-town, thoughtful. They came out of the small, bright lobby onto the street. It was cold, empty, and dark. The boy walked next to his mother, holding her hand, still crying, and they seemed a picture of such amateurish sadness and calamity that I nearly started laughing. Laughing not at the sadness, but at the picture they made of it, at the disparity between their grief and its appearances. My feelings of tenderness and pity were undermined by the sight of them crossing the sidewalk in their bundled clothing, the child determinedly weeping, his mother drooping as she walked, wild-haired, a wretched and pathetic pair. They were inadequate to the spoken grief, the great single-minded anguish. Does this explain the existence of professional mourners? They keep awake from lapsing into comic pathos. What did the doctor say? Give him an aspirin and put him to bed. That's what Denise said. I told him that. He said, well, why didn't you do it? Why didn't we? She's a child, not a doctor. That's why. Did you tell him that? I don't know what I told him, she said. I'm never in control of what I say to doctors, much less what they say to me. There's some kind of disturbance in the air. I know exactly what you mean. It's like having a conversation during a spacewalk, dangling in those heavy suits. Everything drifts and floats. I lie to doctors all the time. So do I. But why? She said. As I started the car, I realized his crying had changed in pitch and quality. The rhythmic urgency had given way to a sustained, inarticulate, and mournful sound. He was keening now. These were expressions of Mideastern lament, of an anguish so accessible that it rushes to overwhelm whatever immediately caused it. There was something permanent and soul-struck in this crying. It was a sound of inbred desolation. What do we do? Think of something, she said. There's still 15 minutes before your class is due to start. Let's take him to the hospital, to the emergency entrance, just to see what they say. You can't take a child to an emergency ward because he's crying. If anything is not an emergency, this would be it. I'll wait in the car, I said.
What do I tell them? My child is crying. Do they even have an emergency ward?
Don't you remember we took the Stovers this past summer?
Why?
Their car was being repaired.